Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. How about something new? Take a cruise around iTunes for lots of other NPR podcasts, including How to Do Everything, How to Steal a Million Barrels of Oil, What Happens When Your Brilliant Plan Falls Apart, and Stuff Your Homeowner's Insurance Policy Really Says. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll dive into the Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, and Mark Ruffalo film, Foxcatcher. What's true, what's not true, and whether we're going to hear more about all of this during Oscar season. And then we'll talk a little bit about trailers. You hear them in the theater, you see them on television, and they may or may not help you decide what you want to see next. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our pal Bob Mondello. Bob, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies for All Things Considered.
We're always so happy when Bob is able to join us, especially when we've got a movie on deck. Now, Bob and I saw Foxcatcher when we were in Toronto. Is that right, Bob?
That is so right. And it was early in the morning.
It was
like 8:30, right?
It was early. It was early. And Foxcatcher, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, particularly in the early going, throughout, but especially in the early going, there are some long stretches of silence and quiet, and it's very kind of,
you're really spoiling some key plot points.
It's very kind of moody and contemplative, and I think I won't specify, but I think that's part of why Bob went and saw it again recently. So Foxcatcher is the story of Channing Tatum plays an Olympic gold medal winning wrestler. His brother is played by Mark Ruffalo, and the brother also is a gold medal winner in wrestling. And Steve Carell plays John DuPont. Eccentric millionaire doesn't really begin to describe it. He's richer than that, and his behavior is kind of more unpredictable than that.
And this is all a true story.
And it's based on a true story. And I think without, you know, specifying what the ultimate ending of this story is, I think it's safe to say it sort of ended very badly. There's kind of a terrible wind up to all of this, and so the film is telling that story, but boy, there seem to have been some liberties taken. We talked a little bit earlier today. For one thing, they compressed the timeline quite a lot, and what was actually a period of, you know, 10 years becomes a period of, you know,
I would have thought it was like 13, 14 months.
Yeah, it's very compressed. I don't know that it's compressed that much.
Well, I saw a quote from Bennett Miller, the director, who also did Capote and
Moneyball. Yeah.
And he described his method with this movie as, quote, fact to fiction as a vehicle back to truth.
I mean, I bought it as a story about this situation, and I read into it a great deal because of the way it was structured.
Right.
I think that that's how film works generally, and it's such an effective film. I think if I were one of those three men, I might feel very differently about this. But as a practical matter, I think it gives you a really interesting look at a world where the struggle of wrestling and the struggle of family are sort of intertwined, and it's a really interesting thing.
Right.
Well, a little context here. Linda Holmes, you and I grew up in an area of the country, the Delaware Valley, where the DuPonts are local royalty. They are the landed gentry. And a huge part of the sort of psychic real estate of that area of the country is occupied with this family. My mom worked at DuPont briefly, at the DuPont Chemical Plant for a while. We would take car trips of a Sunday out to look at not the estates, because you can't see them from the road, but the walls around their estates and look at their horses. Ooh.
And they had,
that.
You know, you would see hospitals that were named after them and, you know, events that were named after them, and they were sponsors of everything.
Absolutely. A huge thing. And so when this happened, this event that takes up the last part of this film, I was no longer living in the area, but I just remember helicopter shots of that compound over and over again. It was just a huge thing, which makes me a bit of a hypocrite because I liked this film a lot. For a film that's as solemn and dour and foreboding as this, and as relatively humorless, I was not prepared to like it as much as I did. But what makes me a hypocrite is that when we talked about Fruitvale Station, my takeaway from that is I wish they'd made a documentary of this. Why are they imposing this sort of narrative onto these events and making me think, well, did he really save a dog? Why am I thinking about a dog at this point? I should just be, the events are what matters.
It's a metaphorical dog.
Exactly. But here, the physicality of these performances, the intensity of these performances were just so amazing. I mean, Channing Tatum walks like every wrestler I knew in high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we came out of this theater, it was kind of like between Carell and Tatum, it was kind of like Underbite Thunderdome, right? Two underbites enter, one underbite leaves.
Yeah.
But Stephen pointed out that Tatum spends the entire movie looking up at you to the camera, like from underneath his heavy, heavy brows.
Mm-hmm.
And Carell spends the entire movie looking down at you over that nose.
Mm-hmm. Over and this prosthetic nose.
And you got to see the poster of this movie. The poster of this movie does an incredible job of just encapsulating these three characters. You've got Channing Tatum looking kind of surly and thick.
Yeah.
You've got Carell being very imperious. And Mark Ruffalo, who is the star of this film as far as I'm concerned, who is just projects such intensity. He's got this expression of his face of just such worry and wariness, and he doesn't know what's coming.
Yeah.
And there are moments between the brothers in this film where Mark Ruffalo is just pouring empathy out of his eyes.
Yeah.
It's just this intense bond that doesn't necessarily get reciprocated because I think that's the relationship of the brothers.
Right.
But it's just this amazing performance. So I really dug this movie. And those concerns about the timeline and everything just didn't even bother me.
I think the reason I understand why this is a pretty fictionalized version of this story trying to get back to the truth is that if you actually tell this real story, it's very hard to get to very much of the truth. I think what you're dealing with is people who, in some cases, are really hard to read. And this is a story that I think is, in real life, lacking a lot of the why that you want in a drama. I think what they did is restructure it as something that almost exists outside of the world of why.
Mm-hmm.
And they just made it this very intense, very emotional experience where you feel the weight of some of these dynamics. And whether or not they are the exact dynamics that existed in real life, which according to Mark Schultz's book, that's the one played by Tatum, these aren't really the same dynamics that existed between these guys in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But the dynamics in the movie feel very authentic and feel very significant without being kind of over-explained and without being over-determined. There's a early scene where the brothers are sort of practice wrestling against each other, warm up and practice wrestling. There is no dialogue, really. I mean, there's, like, I guess, snippets, but mostly what you get is this physical interaction between these two guys and the amount of information that they're able to convey about the nature of this relationship, who's kind of the more nurturing person, who's the more volatile person, who is doing the understanding and tolerating versus who is doing the kind of confused acting out. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount of information that comes out in the way that they conk their bodies together in that early scene.
Yeah, I think that there's a tremendous amount of great acting in this movie, and I think a lot of the emphasis on that has been placed on Steve Carell because it's a larger leap from his usual persona. I would agree that Mark Ruffalo is the strongest performance in this movie. Just the amount of acting in the face that's going on, the amount that you immediately like that guy, even if you're not predisposed to relate to a gold medal winning wrestler, there's so much brotherhood and kindness in the way that he approaches it. And I was curious about the story. I didn't know much about the story before I saw the movie. I did a Google image search for the different principals in this film and was amazed at how much they looked like them.
Yeah. I was struck by the choices the director and the writers made because, not to spoil anything, but when frosted tips show up in this film, they are doing a tremendous amount of narrative work.
Yeah.
They are doing a lot of story heavy lifting. You see them and you're like, oh, I see what's going on.
Yeah, you do.
I know what's happening.
Like, I see where this has gone for this guy. The minute that you see the frosted tips, it's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
You know, I don't think we should understate Channing Tatum. Well, I disagree a little bit about Mark Ruffalo. His is the least showy part. And mm-hmm. I think it's the one that is least likely to be recognized by, say, the Academy.
Right. Mm-hmm. No question.
Which is a shame.
But it's a wonderful performance. What Tatum does, if the way you've experienced him recently, those silly comedies he's been doing, this is shocking. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you first see him, he is so heavy in every respect. Everything about him, it's like his eyebrows look heavy.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous performance and really, really smart.
You know, the other thing about the Tatum performance, and this I assume is a Bennett Miller decision, there are times when they have enough confidence in what's going on in this movie to just hold mm-hmm. on him sitting somewhere or him sitting in and staring out a window or eating. And they just stay with that. And it really drives home where that guy is in his head. And it drives home the kind of solitary nature of what he's doing. And Tatum, to me, is an incredibly interesting guy. Because if you go back to the fact that, like, the first time a lot of people saw him was, I believe, an Abercrombie and Fitch model. And, you know, when he first showed up in Step Up, there was a lot of kind of like, oh, he's a model. Right. Like, this is a movie that's made starring this hot model. And that was the way that was kind of processed. And the first thing that came out of Step Up is, wow, he's a really good dancer. You know, people have a tendency to receive models doing acting in a certain way. And I think the first thing they were able to do was respect the dancing. And then he started to do some of these other, when he did, like, Stop Loss and some other dramatic work. And then he did the comedies, 21 Jump Street and some of the other ones, people started to say, wow, you know what? He's actually pretty funny. In addition to doing Magic Mike, he was also in Haywire, which is another Steven Soderbergh movie that I and a lot of other people consider a little underrated. Mm-hmm. His part in that is not huge, but it kind of represented him getting into the Soderbergh universe a little bit more. You know, now you see him in this movie that's like this Oscars-y performance. Right. But then there's a really wonderful, and I encourage people to seek it out. We'll link to it. There's a really wonderful video that they posted at The Hollywood Reporter of him posing for The Hollywood Reporter and dancing. And they were taking his picture while he was dancing. And honestly, what it made me think of was people like Gene Kelly, whose entire screen presence is so built around dancing. Mm-hmm. Not just in the Fred Astaire ballroom dancing way, and in the kind of movie musical way, but also just their whole physical way of being. His entire way of relating to other people is tied up in dancing.
There's that wonderful scene in Foxcatcher where he's out on the lawn and you're looking at him through the window and he's just sort of doing some wrestling moves, and it says the world. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of, I mean, Steve Carell is what a lot of people have taken away from this movie, and that's that performance we've barely talked about.
Yeah, well, for me, the mannerisms are so above board.
Mannered.
Mannered, exactly. That they do distract a little bit. It's a perfectly great performance. And what it reminded me of, because this guy spends a lot of his time trying to fit in and not doing it well, mm-hmm. just not having the sort of emotional intelligence to fit in, which is, of course, the same territory that Michael Scott worked in. That's not to minimize the performance at all. What it did was reminded me how localized and human and specific that Michael Scott performance was. It wasn't broad. Sometimes it was broad. But mostly, you could find this human in it. That's why the character of Michael Scott in The American Office was so much more empathetic mm-hmm. than the David Brent character in The UK Office.
Yeah.
Because he had a heart. He had a beating heart in the middle of that performance.
Right.
I'd be hard-pressed to find the beating heart in this one.
Well, yeah. It's a
wonderfully creepy performance. And it gets creepier and creepier as you get to know him a little bit better.
It is wonderfully creepy.
But one thing that's in a lot of his performances, though, is a little undercurrent of sadness or melancholy. I mean, he's been in movies like Seeking a Friend for the End of the World or where he's...
Dan in Real Life.
Dan in Real Life was the other one I was trying to think of. That he's a mopey guy, you know, and so I think he accesses some of the things about this character that are clearly very hard for this character, that make you feel a certain... You know, there's a key scene in the movie where he's talking about how his mother had paid a kid to be friends with him.
Yeah.
And you get a sense that, you know, this guy naturally, you know, he has like all the money in the world and really no way to properly enjoy it or anything.
I think he is an example of an actor that makes what he's doing look a lot easier than it is. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we need to take a break, but we'll be right back to talk a little bit about trailers. You know, we've moved beyond In a World, but we've still got a world of trailers. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. So stick around.
If you're a fan of this podcast, know it's made possible in part by Match.com. Number one in dates, relationships, and marriages. Match.com has redefined the way that you can connect with people you want to meet, both online and offline. With nationwide events and the ability to search and communicate with other members, every year, hundreds of thousands of people find love on Match. Match is offering the opportunity to try out Match for 7 days, completely free. Go to trymatch.com to get started with your 7 days free today.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. The other thing we were going to talk about today is trailers. Now, trailers have been around for many, 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 many years. They've taken many forms. You know, I've seen old movie trailers where you would actually get the actor being like, I'm so-and-so, and I'm here to talk to you about such, or the director, or
right.
Walt Disney. Or
I happen to have one of those, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah?
Jessica, play me one more time.
I'm William Castle, and I feel obligated to warn you about the next attraction you will see at this theater. The picture is The Tingler, which I directed. And for the first time in motion picture history, members of the audience, including you, will actually play a part in the picture.
There you go. So this starts with him. We see him. His back is to the camera. He's sitting in a director's chair. It's a set. And he gets up and he kind of leans against the camera and says, let me tell you a little bit about this. And, of course, The Tingler is the film in which the seats are electrified so that when the Tingler is loose in the theater, zit, people and people scream. But yeah, I love that kind of old school kind of, hi.
Yeah.
I'm Troy McClure.
Yeah. You might remember me.
You might remember from, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the old style. And then you kind of got these announcers saying, and starring, sort of like in the, you think of those trailers from like the 50s where it would be like, and with so-and-so as such-and-such. And then, of course, I think kind of the best known era in pop culture is that In a World era, where you really literally did have those like five dudes who did all the movie trailers.
Right. In a world without gas.
In a world where the sun burns cold. In a world where great risks can bring extraordinary rewards.
In a world that's powered by violence.
In a world where owning a radio was strictly forbidden.
I was, when you're talking about it, I was thinking how ordinary trailers feel these days. Yeah. We used to complain that they gave you the whole plot. There's a movie coming out very soon called Into the Woods. From the initial trailer, you would not know it's based on a musical.
Right.
You would have no idea there was music in this thing. It looks like an adventure fantasy picture that has some fairy tale aspects, but you, if you don't know that that is one of the most popular musicals to come out of Broadway in forever and has been performed at every, you know, junior high school on the planet, then you would have no idea from this trailer. And I don't know who they think they're hiding it from, because everybody's, you know, everybody already knows the material.
But remember last year, the movie Frozen, where much was made of the marketing of that movie. It was like, nope, not about girls. It's about the wacky snowman and his buddy. And then, of course, like the movie not only, you know, becomes a gigantic blockbuster hit for what it actually is, which is a story about the relationship between these two sisters, but it specifically becomes a blockbuster hit because of the relationship between those sisters. But they were terrified of that movie being marketed as a story about sisters, so it was marketed as a story about a wacky snowman.
I was going to say that the phenomenon of the teaser trailer is a new one, but then I remembered that I have the Blu-ray of the 1977 film Superman, and there is a teaser trailer included in that mix, so that must have been doing that for a while.
The classic one is Alien.
Right.
Where in space no one can hear you scream was just all you saw in that trailer was an egg. You didn't see anything else. You saw an egg sort of cracking and it was green and oh my God, that looks terrifying. But I didn't know why. You know, you started hearing things about it.
But this phenomenon of they're giving away the whole thing. Over Halloween, I had some friends over to watch some Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe, Roger Corman films because they're on Netflix. And in Netflix, you can see the trailer. So we were trying to choose which one we'd see based on the trailer. Those trailers were not meant to be seen right before you see the movie. Because every single scare is right there. They are meant for you to kind of like see it 1 week and think, oh, I should come back in a month and see this film, and only to be seen once, ephemerally, and not to live online.
Right.
Yeah. They were meant to hit you once and hit you so deeply that you would come back to see it. But everything ruined. Every surprise.
And the trailers of that era are very much, see the movie in which this happens.
Exactly.
You know, they'll actually just come right out and say, in which you see scenes like this.
Yeah, well, and I think like everything else, trailers have been affected by changing media consumption habits. And so there's a big difference between, as you say, a trailer that's intended to be seen simply when it comes at you in a theater and a trailer where somebody is thinking, if we make this trailer right and put it on YouTube, right, people will send it around to each other. And so the trailer really has to be doing more than just advertising the movie. And I think one of the ones that I think of when I think about that shift is the 2010 trailer for The Social Network, mm-hmm, that had the choral version of Creep, where, you know, a trailer typically is 2.5 minutes, and the first minute of that trailer is not movie scenes. It's just the music, and it's people clicking things on Facebook. By the time that trailer actually kicks in as a conventional trailer, you've already had this tremendous setting of mood that is so powerful and so specifically done, so that a choral piece always gives you the idea of sort of something important and sad in a way in movies. So you've already gotten, like, some heft and gravitas and sadness to this story before you even start to see anything else. And they had a piece in Vulture recently about the guy who made that trailer, who is a guy named Mark Woolen. They called him the art house trailer director. And he does, you know, not exclusively super art housey, but, you know, typically not blockbuster stuff. But he did a very well-known trailer for the movie Little Children. He did the trailer for The Tree of Life, and he did the recent trailer for Birdman. He makes kind of these very conceptual trailers where the idea is not to sort of give you a mini version of the movie, but to try to capture, like, what the feeling of the movie is. Because the ideal way to go out of a trailer for me is, I don't really know what that's about, but I want to see it.
Yeah. What I love is when they try to when somebody takes a trailer and then adjusts it for a different kind of consumption. The spoof trailers that have happened, where you turn The Shining into Shining.
That's a classic.
And it's just cheerful. Or Brokeback to the Future.
I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine you invented.
Which is remarkable. And you're playing with one of the elements you were just talking about, which is the music.
Right.
The Brokeback music turns all kinds of scenes in Brokeback to the Future into love story scenes that they clearly aren't and weren't, and I don't remember them that way, but oh my God, when you're looking at it, it's hilarious.
Right, and it really shows, those kind of projects really show how you can manipulate things to look lots of ways.
It's just so important, though, I think, with trailers, in order to get people to watch them on YouTube. You know, so few of them, I think, almost even strive for that. I mean, the most recent example of one that, to me, I saw getting sent around was the 50 Shades of Grey trailer, which not only was their interest in, like, oh my God, what are they going to do? It's probably going to suck. But that trailer has a version of Beyoncé's Crazy in Love in it that they slow way down. You feel like you're seeing... You feel like, if nothing else, and I don't give a crap about that movie, but I was curious to hear that song spun that way. And I think any time you can, I mean, the choral version of Creep is a good example of, you know, of that, where if you can throw out some sort of a sample of some music or something that will get people talking, it's so much more important than just assembling a bunch of scenes together.
Well, the trailer for Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, the American version, was just this incredible montage of really fast-paced music, really fast cuts that created this very distressing and disturbing feeling. It can steer you wrong. I remember the trailer for The Descendants, the George Clooney film, coming off as much more funny than that film ended up being. There was a different cut of that trailer that just made a promise that the movie didn't.
What it made it look
kind of Coen Brothers-y to me.
Right.
It made it look kind of like the dark comedy, but still comedy, of something like Burn After Reading or A Serious Man, when it's neither of those things.
Yeah. And I just saw a trailer for a film called Tomorrowland, which is coming out next year. And that trailer consists essentially, largely, of a scene from the movie start to finish. And that's a really intriguing thing to do. But that means that when that scene comes on in summer 2015,
you'll just be able to recite it from memory.
It's I can tell I'm going to be disappointed by that scene. Brief tangent. The coming next week on television are done in a variety of different ways. Mad Men nails it because that guy, Matthew Weiner, is deliberately obscure, willfully obscure. We will see cuts, really quick cuts of somebody saying, do you want a sandwich? And that's all we get.
Next week, portent.
Yeah, it's exactly. Totally out of context.
And it's completely out of context because he's like, screw you, AMC. I'm not doing this.
Yeah. The ones that I always think are funny are the ones where I'm so excited about the movie from seeing the trailer. And then the movie turns out to be such a disappointment. I think I've mentioned this before, but I remember a trailer for Twister.
I was just going to say, I hope somebody mentions Twister.
That I thought was so... The trailer campaign for that movie was so great. I've never been able to find it online. There are things that are close, but I'm pretty sure the thing I saw was something else that really was just the sound and the rattling of the cellar when they're in the cellar at the beginning of that movie. And I remember just thinking, this just seems like it is going to be the most fun thing. This is amazing. This is so scary.
And you felt that it wasn't?
Well, it's a very different movie than that. You get this whole thing of like, it's going to be about the married couple fighting. And it's an adventure movie. It's a different kind of movie from kind of the almost horror movie was implied by that trailer.
That trailer set the bar so incredibly high for that movie.
Yeah.
The trailer for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves famously included a shot of the arrow flying through the air that wasn't in the actual film, so they made it part of the film. Because it tested so well, because people were going gaga over that one shot, so they inserted it into the film later. That might be apocryphal, but that's something I heard.
I have seen trailers in the past where they have whole scenes that are not, forgive me, I can't remember them right now, but this is many years in the past because now...
No, it happens occasionally. Yeah,
they just aren't in the movie. Right. And I look at it and later and think, well, where was that moment? The trailer that set me up for something, I didn't like Nine when I saw it on Broadway, the Broadway musical, but I liked it reasonably well. And when I saw the cast, I thought, oh my God, this has everybody. There's a moment in the trailer where there's a swell in the music and Sophia Loren turns in slow motion. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be the greatest movie in the history of the world. And then I saw it and I was like, deadly.
There's a scene in the trailer for Who Framed Roger Rabbit where we get a shot of Bob Hoskins with a pig head where he says, I'm a pig. That is not in the film.
Yes. Well, you do also learn after a while that there are certain conventions that if you watch enough movie trailers, it is shocking how often they do the same thing. There is a convention, for example, and this is one that I've started to notice recently, where somebody will be like, what the? And then just as they're about to swear, like it cuts to like an explosion or something like that. And I wrote a blog post a while ago about the use of silence in trailers, that it seemed like all of a sudden the new thing was to cut out all the sound at some point in the trailer. The Godzilla trailer had this, that all of a sudden they make a space for a moment in which everything becomes silent. And then, of course, everything explodes again. And it's like they realized that the trailers had gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and louder and louder and louder. And the only thing left that people would kind of be like, what just happened?
Because you have to jolt people out of their seats because they'll tune it out. They'll tune out the rhythms.
Everybody is sitting there eating their popcorn, talking to the person next to them, texting. I'm just saying it happens during the trailers. And then the only way to get their attention is all of a sudden it's quiet. Yeah. And then you hear people talking.
Which is another reason why a lot of comedy films and horror films both use the button at the end. Yeah. After the title comes up, there's another sting, there's another joke, to kind of shake people out of their reverie.
Well, here's a question about trailers. Can I ask a question about trailers? How often does it happen to you that you watch a trailer for a comedy that looks horrible and unfunny, and then the trailer is over, and you're sitting in the silence, and you're listening to people laugh, and you're like, you people are what is wrong?
Philistines, all of you.
And I always feel like a terrible person, but when I'm sitting there and like people are laughing, like I know I should be happy, other people are laughing.
Stop laughing!
But when I sit there and I think, this looks like the worst thing I've ever seen, and then it invariably ends with like a shot of a guy. It ends with a fart, or it ends with a guy getting stapled in the crotch. And then you cut and you sit in the silence, and there's that miserable moment where you're sitting in the silence resenting the trailer you just thought, and the person behind you is going,
except it's usually my husband laughing his ass off.
And the next week it does $38.9 million.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I can't take it. It's the absolute worst thing. All right. Well, far away from the worst thing in the world, when we come back, joy, excitement, it is what is making us happy this week, and we will be right back.
A quick shout out to thank our sponsor, Emma. These guys offer tools for email marketing. With Emma, you can create sophisticated automated email campaigns and deliver targeted messages to your audience. The interface is super intuitive, so your team can create great-looking emails in a drag-and-drop editor and track the results easily using an interactive click map that shows where people are clicking in your email. Emma's great for marketing teams or agencies who want to upgrade from the more DIY services but don't want the complexity and expense of an enterprise system. Give them a try at myemma.com.
All right. Well, it is time for our favorite segment of the week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
First of all, I made a catastrophic blunder on last week's episode where I said there needs to be a word for nostalgic enterprises that make you feel a certain amount of dread. And Linda immediately, 1 second later, came up with what I thought at the time to be a perfect word, which was nostalgia. It's great. Brilliant under the circumstances, but I forgot, and I got a text message from Mike Katziff, our producer emeritus and music director, the day the podcast came out, that says, "You forgot about my word." Mike had a perfect word for this exact phenomenon, and that word, anticipointment.
Ooh,
which is so good. Now, nostalgia, Linda. Brilliant. Brilliant effort. I love the word. We can use it, but I don't want us to forget about anticipation.
I just got demoted.
What we have here is a dichotomy.
That's
We have nostalgia people and what was the other
one? Anticipation.
Anticipation people, yeah.
I actually have a recommendation. Season 2 of MasterChef Junior, a Gordon Ramsay cooking show on Fox that contains very little yelling. It is a fairly brief and contained run. The first season is only 7 episodes. As the title of the show, it's all there in the title of the show, MasterChef Junior. It is just kids who are somehow phenomenally amazing at cooking. They are, I believe the age range is between 8 and 13.
That's correct, I think.
And because they can't have Gordon Ramsay calling these children donkeys, it is this delightful and wonderfully good-natured show. I have 2 children at home who happen to fit into that age range, one of whom is obsessed with cooking. And so we blazed through the entire first season of MasterChef Junior in one very lazy sitting. It is just delightful.
I'm 9 years old.
Describe your dish.
Spicy seared pork loin with mixed vegetables / fruits, a mustard sauce, and fried egg on top.
It's a wonderful show. As insecure as it makes me feel as a cook, that is how delighted it makes me as a viewer.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
2 things. You know, a lot of people have been telling me to watch the web series High Maintenance, and they've been telling me this for a while, and they would get as far as the premise, which is there's a weed dealer in Brooklyn, and I'd be like, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
Drug jokes and hipsters in Williamsburg, like, no thanks. But the show is remarkably smart, wry, unforced, funny, but it's more about little vignettes as this weed dealer intersects these lives. We start to see it's actually building to something. We see these lives intersect. We get this patchwork together of all these different things, some of which are funny, some of which are sad, some of which are poignant. It's really smart. Each episode is only 5 to 15 minutes long. The first 13 episodes are free. Most recently, they just launched 3 more, which just went on the web now, on Vimeo. You got to pay for those, which led to a lot of pop culture writers saying, oh, the first taste is always free, so let's do that. But it's just a great, and, you know, you mentioned well-intentioned, it's got a generosity of spirit that I really like. The other one is, a lot of us sometimes feel the need to see a black-and-white Wim Wenders film where people are staring morosely into the middle distance, and They're being very sad, and at some point the lead actress stares into her makeup mirror, which is the camera, and she says, Leere, and the subtitle comes up, emptiness. Sometimes we want that. When you want the polar opposite of that, I will recommend a film by Jon Favreau called Chef. This is a very agreeable puppy dog film, which is engineered to be just likable. And it's about a chef who falls on hard times and who recreates himself with the help of some plucky friends and pulls himself up by his bootstraps and just gets back into it with Cuban food. Everything about this film, it's Cuban food and it's great music and it's Jon Favreau and it's really kind of witty. It's just great. It is not complex and so inoffensive as to be maybe slight, but I dug it. So that's Chef by Jon Favreau.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy is how hungry everybody seems.
I was gonna say, little theme here.
It's all food shows.
Including
high maintenance.
It is a fact of life, if you're a critic, that you see things before anybody else. This was even true in my life before I became a critic. Back when I was a publicist for movie theater, I'd see things. I remember calling a friend of mine and saying, I'm going to a screening this afternoon. I think it's about deer hunting. You want to go? And we went to see it.
I think it's about deer hunting.
About 90 minutes in, it wasn't about deers anymore. Uh-huh. Anyway, I was completely freaked out and wanted so much to talk to somebody about it. But it was 2.5 months before I could talk to anybody about it. Well, Linda, you'll appreciate this. The same thing happens to me at Toronto every year. It is so weird to go and see things in early September that no one else is going to see until almost Christmas. Well, finally, this week, actually the last couple of weeks, we've had a bunch of pictures opening that we saw in Toronto. So now I can talk to people about Nightcrawler and Pride and Theory of Everything and Rosewater. It is such a relief to be able to talk about them without everybody accusing you of spoiling everything for them. And so that's what's making me happy.
I have two things making me happy this week. The first is a podcast that we have talked about on this show a few times, which is Mark Maron's WTF. We have also talked a few times about Ali Brosh, who is the cartoonist who does Hyperbole and a Half. I was kind of surprised that Ali Brosh sat down for WTF. I think of her as someone who's pretty reticent about interviews. I think of her as someone who doesn't love to talk about herself in that kind of setting, who basically uses her art to talk about herself. And she sat with Mark Maron for an hour, and they talked about some very personal, very serious, very kind of gutting things from her life, her experiences with depression and anxiety. It's really, for me, Maron at his best and most useful, because what his willingness to be a big open wound does for people who come on that show is make it okay for them to be that same way. There becomes this affinity between the two of them over the course of this conversation that I think allows her to feel like she can talk about things that I'm not sure she talks about a lot in public conversations. As I said, I think she uses her art for that a lot of the time. It's great to hear her talk. I enjoyed it a lot. Again, it's the not currently the most recent episode, but a recent episode of Mark Maron's podcast, WTF, with Ali Brosh. The other thing is a really lovely, intelligent piece that Adam Sternberg wrote for New York Magazine about emoji, the little faces that are in text messages and stuff like that. And what I love about Adam's writing is that he's always able to find a way into cultural things that's extremely smart. It doesn't over-academicize everything, and yet it's really intelligent. And so his take on emoji is very personal in the sense that it still understands that this is a really intimate part of personal conversations, and that's where you need to come from when you talk about it. But it's a very sensitive, it's never condescending. It's essentially a linguistic look at how these are developing as part of conversations that people have. And he wraps up with this really lovely paragraph that leaves a lot of space for kind of how culture develops. And he says, among other things, this new way will not replace all the old ways, but it can augment them and help us muddle through. In lieu of being able to read each other's faces when we say these things, we've developed these surrogate faces. They're simple. They're silly. They don't yet have a taco. But they work, at least a little, at least right now. It's a really good piece. Again, New York Magazine, Adam Sternberg, writing about emoji. And I recommend that. And that is also making me very happy this week. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow Bob at Bob_Mondello. It's Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
It was great.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. How about something new? Take a cruise around iTunes for lots of other NPR podcasts, including How to Do Everything, How to Steal a Million Barrels of Oil, What Happens When Your Brilliant Plan Falls Apart, and Stuff Your Homeowner's Insurance Policy Really Says. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts.